TV. TV.
Okay, TV.
A podcast of the television. So
we're not here.
We're not. This is a kind of a special episode. We've never done a live show. A lot of podcasts are comedy people, and so they do these live shows in front of a live audience. And we've never done that before. But
and we probably never will.
It's you never know. Never say never.
Well,
anyway, we were asked, however, to moderate a conversation with Brian Fuller at the recent L.A. Lambda Lit Fest. And we thought that we would make this special episode of LKTV available to everybody so we could talk about his new show, American Gods, that's premiering on Stars this Sunday, April 30th. And if you want to get LKTV, it's normally available only to our Patreon subscribers. That's at patreon.com/linoleumknife. You can get LKTV. You can get our food show, Linoleum Knife and Fork, and lots of other great extras and prizes. And in fact, if you are become an LKTV subscriber, you'll have access to all of our archived shows, including another interview that we did with Brian Fuller.
That was our, like our first.
That was our first episode.
Yeah.
Our first subscriber episode.
Yeah.
Right around the time that American Gods was going into production. So if you're a Fuller fan, there's more to be found over at Patreon.
Is there audience noise?
There's audience noise. There's questions from the audience.
All right.
This is very
is
much
the sound quality.
It's pretty good.
Is it good?
This got taped right out of the board. So,
is it better than the normal sound quality?
It's completely possible. Anyway, we hope to do this again sometime, but we always love talking to Brian, and he had a lot to say. You know, because it was a literary festival, we talked a lot about adaptation, because of course, you know, American Gods is based on a novel by Neil Gaiman.
Right.
But, you know, not his first time at working on other people's stuff. You know, Hannibal obviously was based on the Thomas Harris novels, and one of his first big network writing gigs after working on Star Trek was doing a TV movie adaptation of Carrie for NBC, which was kind of supposed to be a pilot, but they wound up not going any further with it. But anyway, he gives all the dirt about how that happened and his whole process of, taking a novel and turning it into TV. So anyway, we hope you enjoy this, and we hope you'll come back and listen to more LKTV. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Enjoy.
All right. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Tony Valenzuela. I'm the executive director of Lambda Literary. I'd like to welcome you to the first annual Lambda Lit Fest Los Angeles. Tonight's special program is a part of this first annual festival. It's an evening with the incredible Brian Fuller, executive producer and co-showrunner. Executive producer and co-showrunner on Starz, American Gods, among many other, as writer and producer, great series like Hannibal, Wonderfalls, and of course, Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, and Star Trek Voyager, among others. Pushing Daisies, exactly. He will be in conversation with our favorite film critics and co-hosts of Linoleum Knife podcast, Alonso Duralde and Dave White. We're featuring in the festival over 30 amazing programs all week, all over LA. And you can find out about them at lambdalitfest.org. This festival is made possible because of the City of LA, Department of Cultural Affairs, and the City of West Hollywood, WeHo Arts. So we'd like to thank our sponsors. And for those of you who don't know, Lambda Literary is the largest LGBTQ literary organization in the world. We have events and programs year-round, including an LGBT Emerging Writers Residency every summer here in LA. We have an LGBT Writers in Schools program in New York City Public Schools. We run the largest publication of queer book reviews in the world, and we give prizes and awards honoring excellence to our community's writers. There's a lot more that Lambda does, and I invite you to visit our website, lambdaliterary.org, to learn more about us and how to get involved. The Lambda Literary Festival Showcase Day is Saturday at Barnstall Gallery Theater in Hollywood. There's going to be a whole day of panel conversations about the urgent questions that we're facing as communities today. And then it's ending with a queer night of comedy. So it's from 11 a.m. till 10 p.m. at Barnstall. I just invite you to show up and show up early to the events because, like, all the Eventbrite tickets are sold out, but, you know, not everyone shows up. So please show up early. They're going to be amazing conversations and entertainment. We're thrilled to welcome this festival to L.A. It's going to be an annual thing as a new tradition showcasing queer artists in this great city. And now please welcome our special guests, Brian Fuller, and our hosts, Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, with a big round of applause.
Good evening, everybody. I'm so glad you wore red. I didn't have anything. I just want to be clear, I'm totally down for Day Without a Woman. I just didn't have any red that was, you know, in my interviewing wardrobe. So you are covering the whole
Brian
thing.
Likes
so we're good.
Brian likes women more than you do.
Yes, he wins. Do you want to start us?
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming out. And thank you, Lambda Festival, for having us here.
No, this is very exciting, actually, because, you know, to be talking to a TV writer at a literary festival, I think in years past that might have, you know, raised some eyebrows. But obviously, there's a lot of great writing happening in television right now. And your career, especially, in addition to just being interesting on its face, you know, you've adapt a lot of literary properties, and so I think, you know, we have a lot to cover tonight.
Let's begin the interrogation. I want to talk about how you got your start. You know, where do you come from, and what made you think you were any good, and where did the early confidence in your ability to make this type of life happen?
That was loud. Are you asking, like, what brought me to a creative field, or, like, what sort of childhood trauma?
I need to know the catalyst event.
One of the catalyst events, which is a common catalyst event for most of us, is that I had a teacher believe in me. And that's something that I think we can all relate to, like, oh, that one person who pushed a little bit harder than they normally would and got us through the door. So I was studying to be a psychiatrist at a local community college in Idaho, and all of the psychological examples I used were from movies, and finally I did I proposed an experiment, which was, do you get more out of a movie if you understand the psychological subtext of it, or viewing it as a popcorn experience? And I used the film Alien as the model, and it was like, on one hand, it's, you know, 10 little Indians on a spaceship. On the other hand, those doors look like vaginas. That's a penis-headed monster. The mother betrayed her children for cock. And there is a lot of interesting psychological Freudian themes going on there.
Sometimes a cigar-shaped spaceship is just a cigar-shaped.
But the alien head is a penis.
Okay, so you finish school, and what happens?
Well, to finish that anecdote, the instructor told me basically that after he read that experiment proposal, that I had no business being in that school and I needed to go to film school. And then I said, well, that was something that other people do, and it was not a craft that I understood as something that was accessible to me. And there was a student-teacher meeting, and I came in, and there was just film school applications across his desk. And he said, like, pick four and start applying. And I did, and I got into USC, but that was no big feat because anybody can get into – I didn't even take SATs. It's not that, like, that hard. I got student loans, and it's not prestigious at all. So you, too, can get in without taking SATs to USC. Good school.
And obviously at USC you learned a lot of the craft, but a lot of what you gleaned about how TV works and how TV is written, you kind of figured out on your own, correct?
I read a lot of scripts. It started with I was obsessed with Star Trek. Loved Star Trek, and I was aware that there was an open script submission policy for that show because they were constantly looking for new ideas, and I wrote a spec script and submitted it and they passed on it. Then I wrote another spec script and that got me in the door, and I pitched the script that they rejected and sold that and then sold another story, and then they asked me to come in to write a script for Voyager. To kill off a character named Kes, who is being replaced by Jerry Ryan to play Seven of Nine. So I came up with, like, every day I drove onto the Paramount lot, told them I was a messenger, and slipped how to kill Kes ideas underneath the producer door until they said they would give me the script. And then I ended up writing something else.
So we're focusing mostly tonight on your literary adaptations, but Star Trek is an adaptation.
Yes.
And how do you, in a general sense, walk into those established parameters and operate in that world that's already set up for you?
A big part of it is fan fiction, as some people in the audience know, that I feel like those adaptations are fan fictions. Hannibal was absolutely fan fiction. I was obsessed with Thomas Harris's books. I loved the movies, all of them except for Hannibal Rising, and got...
But he likes Hannibal Rising.
Yeah, it's... So really you have to approach the material as a fan, because as a fan you know what the loyal audience member wants, because it's you. And so for both Hannibal and American Gods and Carrie, I was obsessed with each of those books, so it was just a matter of, like, okay, I've already read this and visualized it once, so how do I bring the authentic experience to the audience that I had reading it?
Well, you bring up an interesting point about fan fiction, and it, I can see that as sort of a through line for your work, but where's the and not in a bad way, but what is the danger of accommodating fans of any given, you know, universe or property versus taking it in places that they might not like, but that serve a greater purpose in terms of telling an interesting story or making a point that, you know, fans might be, oh, hey, you killed that character that I like. And, you know, they you're not answering to them, but you're answering to the work, I guess.
Yeah, it's just trying to remain authentic. And, you know, the TV show Hannibal is a wildly different interpretation of those characters and that dynamic. And really was ended up in a place that I didn't anticipate going, because I was like, oh, well, while we're here, we might as well talk about love. I didn't have an agenda. It was just sort of like I went through a stroll in a homoerotic forest and found myself at a big wet pond.
Things just fell out of the trees.
I had to eat.
So going back to Carrie, With the Carrie film, you were dealing with a couple of issues. There was obviously a prior film adaptation that's legendary, and you were also having to restructure the story because it was going to be a TV pilot. Is that correct? Now, so you have to open up a
previous... It was a backdoor pilot.
Say what now? I'm sorry?
A backdoor pilot.
Yeah. You have to open up a previously closed ending. So how did you address all of those challenges? Because, I mean, I know how you feel about Carrie the film.
Yeah.
And so, how do you feel about the finished project?
It was an interesting process because it was probably the most fun I've ever had writing anything, because it was before I had been in production on Dead Like Me or Carrie or Wonder Falls. Before I knew the kind of arduous birthing process it is to produce a show. So I was completely naive to the terrors of production that were waiting for me around the corner. So I had a ball writing it. And, there was a difference about doing it when we did it in the early aughts, because it was after Columbine. And that completely reframed the story for me, and I thought that was interesting. And I thought there were still a lot of things in the book that hadn't been adapted, so it felt like, oh, this is valid. It's valid to do this again. It's also valid to have a commentary on bullying and the consequences of bullying for the bullies. And the wish fulfillment of that was an interesting extrapolation of everything that was going on socially with high school students. So it felt valid. I thought Angela Bettis and Patricia Clarkson were absolutely amazing. And I think there's a good movie in there, but we stepped on a lot of landmines that Brian De Palma avoided very eloquently, and simplified the story in a way that we overcomplicated it. So I think that if we cut that movie in half strategically, it would be great, because Angela Bettis and Patricia Clarkson are so compelling as actresses. But you're never going to beat that original for all sorts of reasons. And that's my answer.
I do want to circle back, though, just to talk about the ending, because that does play such a big role in what makes the book and the De Palma version so effective. Knowing going in that that was not going to be your option, how did you feel you were able to sort of be true to the spirit of what Carrie's about and the message that it sends, while also fulfilling the sort of nuts and bolts of what a backdoor pilot has to be?
Well, in really pretentious, like, network pitch speak of the show, it was like, well, now Carrie killed a whole bunch of people. She's got some shit to work through. Let's tell that story. So that seemed like it was an interesting alley to go down. And also, it felt like there was a Kimmy Schmidt quality to Carrie getting out into the world that felt like it could be a good story engine.
Did it ever get to a place where you started any kind of outlines of what a Carrie season one would have been like?
Yeah, there was a second episode that involved a massive bridge collapse that Carrie caused. And I guess I must have seen the Mothman prophecies like at some point. But it didn't happen, and it probably shouldn't have.
So during this period, you're also creating original shows. So Dead Like Me, Wonder Falls, you co-create Wonder Falls, Pushing Daisies. To people outside this process, like me, it seems like this would be night and day. You know, one is whatever you can think up in your head, and the other is you're walking into someone else's world. Now, so you've done a lot of both. How does adapting something that someone else created, how does that change how you work?
It takes away a level of fear because I know that the story works because I've seen it. I've seen the characters, like most of the heavy lifting and the particulars of the story, that work has already been done. So in a way, my job is like a director's job or an actor's job in that we are reacting to the material as opposed to generating it. So I'm reacting to those, the novels and having a certain, instinct on where to go with it.
You have a preference or do they each have their own appeal?
I think they each have their own appeal. I'm definitely itching to open up my script drawer and go back to some of the original ideas that I've been working on before I got busy with Hannibal and then American Gods. I'm itching to go back to originals, to something original, and like I've been, I'll stop there. Yeah.
Now, which of the adaptations that you've worked on, did you initiate all of them or did they come to you? Were they brought to you?
They each came to me in a different way. Carrie came to me because I'd just written Dead Like Me for the same television studio. And they're like, hey, do you like Carrie? And I was like, I love Carrie. And they're like, want to do Carrie? And I said, yes, I'd love to do Carrie. And Hannibal, I was on a plane, and a friend of mine who just works for a company who just acquired the rights was like, do you think Hannibal could be a TV show? And I was like, yes, here's how you do it.
You had already thought about this.
I hadn't thought about it, but I just knew it was like Angelica Houston in Manhattan Murder Mystery. I'm going to use the bathroom, and when I come back, I'll tell you who the killer is. So it was one of those.
And with Gods?
With Gods, they had reached out, and my agent called and said, are you a fan of American Gods? And I was like, yes. And he said, do you want to meet on it? And it was during season 2 of Hannibal, and our ratings were terrible, so I was like, this ain't going another year. So I thought, well, yeah, I'll start that conversation. I talked to them, and then I just got swept up in Hannibal. And I remember the last day of shooting on season 2, we wrapped at like 7 a.m. And then at 11 a.m., I was having tea with Neil Gaiman, who flew in to Toronto just to see if I was somebody that he wanted to work with. And we spent the entire time talking about immigration and what this story is really about and who can't relate to being a stranger in a strange land trying to figure out what you believe in. And he was like, I he should do it.
So when Hannibal was in the idea stage, what was your original idea versus what wound up on TV?
What was your airplane pitch?
The original idea was essentially I wanted to use Hannibal and Will as a vehicle to explore non-physical straight guy romances. And, you know, as a gay man growing up around straight men and seeing how they interact and how different it was and how I didn't relate to it. It was so alien to me, the circle jerks and all of that stuff. I was like, what's going on with you people? it felt like, okay, let's explore non-physical male love and all of the jealousies and the obsessions that come with romance. And that was my first instinct. And then I also knew I wanted to have a relationship between Hannibal and his therapist. And that was going to be a pivotal part of the show because most therapists have a therapist to help guide them. And I just thought, who's that lady? So those were the two things I knew I that were the big appeals for me.
So when I first heard that Hannibal was happening, I, because of the social media, you know, I'm consuming, a lot of it is pro you, but a lot of it was also anti having this even be rehashed. How do you, can you operate without thinking about that? Because I, over time, when the show finally came on, you know, when it finally hit the air, people were like, oh, well, this is exactly what we wanted it to be. But leading up to it, there's this, I think there's a fatigue sometimes on the part of audiences when they are told, oh, you're going to get a new version of this thing you already know. And our first response is often, no, we don't want that. And the only reason I wanted it was because I knew you were associated with it. And that's, and it was good. So can you work creatively if you are feeling the pressure of taking this established property in a new direction?
With Hannibal and the reaction, generally you get any sort of immediate reaction to everything now. And usually when I see a negative reaction, I think, oh, well, they just don't know what I'm planning. So yes, if you told me when they said Bates Motel, they were doing Bates Motel, my first reaction was like, let me at it because I just want to make sure it's something I want to watch. And the other part was there's so many bad versions that they could do of this. And it turns out they did an amazing version. And the show is spectacular and thoughtful and fan fiction, like the most fantastic fan fiction, those scenes of him talking to his dead mother as she's vacuuming the house, it's all really gripping and what I want to see as a fan. So I lost my point if I'm answering your question or not.
Sure you did. Right. You totally did. So with American Gods, this is the first time that you're the first person to take on the book.
Yes.
This is you're the first adapter.
Yes. Yes. Myself and Michael Green. Yes.
So how did this come about?
So after the meeting with Neil, we got a season three order on Hannibal, and it was like, oh, I can't jump right into that now, but how about if I get a partner and we can work together while we're completing Hannibal season three, and then I can just segue right into it and we'll have, you know, we'll write three scripts while I'm, you know, also doing Hannibal. And, cause I was like, there's no way it's going to get a season four, but in case we do, I have this idea. So we prepped American Gods to go, and it's the most complicated show I've ever worked on. It was like a year of writing and prepping, a year, 8 months of filming and 8 months of post, where it's the most complicated post process I've ever been a part of. And our mutual friend Shannon is like, you should do movies. It's so much simpler because we've got in three episodes that we're trying to finish in the next month, we've got like over 1,000 visual effects. So, in our last episode, there are almost 500 visual effects, and in Titanic, there were 460. So, there's a lot of look I'll be very curious to see how it is met by the audience, because it's absolutely a different show than it was when we wrote it, because November happened and all of a sudden all of these immigration issues that we thought, we're in a progressive environment, this is going to be fine. Now, like, there's a scene and a very minor character asks a god who's coming to call on her, why are you here? This is a Muslim home. And I was like, Muslim, like it's like there's now it's very political because we have gay Muslims. We have scenes on slave ships that are very politically aggressive. We have after the election, the next day we were screening a rough cut of the finale, and the finale is all about how the opening is telling the story of Bilquis, and Bilquis is coming to America. And if you don't know the book, she's the one who eats men with her vagina. And so it was her coming to America, because every episode opens with a coming to America story. But hers is like a 15-minute opening that is all about the links that men will go to take down a woman of power. And it was just, it was like, oh my God. It was so depressing because it was the next day and everybody was in shock. And so, it is a different show than we set out to make because of the current political environment.
So you had this meeting with Gaiman. I'm curious, how involved has he been over the process, or I mean, a little or a lot or none? And did you have any encounters, or how much, with either Thomas Harris or Stephen King in those processes?
No contact whatsoever with Thomas Harris. That was all through Martha De Laurentiis, so there's no proof he exists. And I've joked before that he's, you know, in a zipper mask in a steamer trunk at the foot of her bed, which seems like something out of a Thomas Harris novel. And with Stephen King, no contact either. But after we filmed the show, I went to send him a Carrie dress because we had a few of them, and it was covered in ants because of the Karo syrup and all the blood. So it was this, it just looked like a person had gotten into a sandwich bag and it was, you know, tenderized. It was ridiculous. So we dry cleaned it and then sent it to him, but I don't know if he ever received it. But Neil Gaiman, on the other hand, we speak to frequently and is very involved and has had feedback on lots of things and, you know, reacts to outlines and dailies and scripts and has only once said, please don't do that. No, if you do that, I will throw myself in front of a bus. And we said, okay, we won't do that.
You don't want that on your head.
No.
Well, there's a place of negotiation.
Yes.
Now, is this a thing like Leftovers where you could conceivably run out of book at some point and you're left to your own devices, or do you end season one at a place where you've still got more book to cover?
Oh, God, we've got so much more book to cover. We end season one and we're like 120 pages into the book. So it's only 8 episodes. So it's, really digestible. And, so there's a lot more story to go. And there's also, the opportunity to Marvelize the universe and do a Mr. Nancy spinoff with Orlando Jones, who is absolutely fantastic in the show. He's so incredible. And got a round of applause. We opened episode 2 on a slave ship coming to America, and there's an African man praying to Anansi, and Anansi comes to visit him in modern day, like a 3-piece plaid suit, but much more vibrant than Hannibal's, and and tells him what is awaiting the black man in America. And it's this mohawk of a monologue that is all about, you know, written by a couple of white guys about the things that you should be pissed off about. And he did the first take, and 40 actors, all black men, stood up and applauded his performance because he was so good. And that was the moment I remember seeing the dailies, because I wasn't on set for that, But we were watching the dailies when they came in, a bunch of us just gathered in post, and we were like, oh, this is – we may be actually about something that's important to discuss.
Well, come on. Every show that you've done, and I've seen them all, they're about more than what we're about. Seeing. So they're all about something.
And, yes.
And I find that that's one of the things that keeps coming. I keep coming back to you for that, underlayer of text.
And I gotta get out flashback. You're in the underlayer.
Yeah. Now you're in the sunken place now, yes. And you've just derailed me a minute ago by telling me that the post on this is even more intense than the other shows, because one of your reputations is shows that you can watch with the sound down and still be visually overwhelmed by the level of detail packed into the frame of your television set. So how is it possible that this is even more than the ones before? Like, I remember I interviewed Baz Luhrmann like 15 years ago, and I asked him about Moulin Rouge. And I said, what percent of what was in your head wound up on screen? And he said, like 60%. And I thought, I don't want to be inside your head.
I do.
Yeah. So how is this even more visually detailed than the stuff you've already done?
I think we had a studio and a network that really wanted to wow an audience, because the marketplace is so crowded right now with so much television that I actually, the other night, I went to pick something to watch, and I was so overwhelmed by the Netflix menu that I just picked up a book. I was like, I can't. So I think we have to be competitive now. I think there's something about what's happening in television that is allowing people to do unique things, because there's so much else out there that you don't want to be like. And it feels like American – I haven't seen the show American Gods before represented in this way. So it feels fresh on that front. But we're also – I mean, it's going on 3 years that I've been working on it, so I don't quite see it clearly, but it's – it's massive. All the people who came to work on it to contribute their visions to the whole vision. There's a lot of really smart directors with great eyes that helped us build this, and it is pretty. I mean, you saw 1 in 4.
Yes.
And you should tell the people to see it when it comes on.
You should see it when it comes on.
So it's yeah, we went for it, and they let us go for it, and you know, it's that doesn't happen often. It rarely happens where you get to go as far as we were able to go in 8 episodes for American Gods.
I remember I started paying close attention to the Hannibal credits, because you had a writing credit on practically every one of them, which not a lot of people who've at your position do. I mean, creators have, you know, they do it. There's a lot of delegating that goes on, but you are in there rewriting and you know, doing stuff on practically every episode of that show for a 3-year period. Do you notice the difference working with Michael Green, having a partner, not feeling, are you shouldering less of this burden of this, putting together this program than with Hannibal, where you were clearly week in, week out, like having to be in there to punch up the writing or whatever it was that you were doing on each script?
I mean, working with Michael has been fantastic. And we met on Heroes season 1 and just got along really well and kind of liked the same things and had similar senses of humor. And we had been talking about how do we get back to doing something together again. And then when season three of Hannibal was ordered and I couldn't focus on American Gods, I was like, how about let's do this together? And he was like, I'm in 100%. And so it's been great because we write the scripts together, a lot of the scripts, and rewrite other scripts. And he takes scenes, he writes, I take scenes, I write. We kick them back to each other. And if it's most of the time, he will suggest adding something for me, and most of the time I will suggest cutting something for him. And then the scripts sort of feel like one writer wrote them.
And is it the kind of thing where, given that you're dealing with something more direct adaptation-wise here than, say, with Hannibal, you know, would you have the book handy in the office and sort of look at that as kind of the source text if there was a discussion about which way to go on things, or at some point you'd have to sort of lock it away in a drawer and go off in your own direction?
You know, we referenced the book quite a bit because we want it to be authentic, but a lot of what we were doing, there are scenes that are lifted right out of the book and put into the show. And those are always delight because it's like, I just wrote 5 pages and it took me 10 minutes. Yeah, exactly. Those are always, more fun, but, what was the question?
Did you feel that the book was sort of the final arbiter of how things should go, or were you secure in having it as being a jumping off point?
We felt like Neil was the final arbiter of where things should go, and Neil was very excited that we were telling chapters between chapters. And so if there was ever anything that was kind of a fork in the road that wasn't in the book, we would call Neil and say, we want to do this thing, but it does this, this, and this. And he'd say, well, I'm comfortable with those two, but not that one. And if you did this, it would help me. And then we do what he asked us to do.
So day in, day out, what's your writing process like? What are the mundane mechanics of that?
Well, I've been so heavily in post for the last, since we stopped shooting in October, that I've only got to write just a little bit, but because we are in sound mixes and color timing, because the look of the show is very specific and the sound of the show is very specific. So Michael and I are in a lot of post-production things that a showrunner normally wouldn't be. They just hand them off, but none of us have ever done a show like American Gods, so we want to just make sure that at least for the first season, it's bespoke through and through. And so right now I get up, go to Pilates, and then from there I am in either a sound mix. I have my associate producer Danny, who is my external hard drive, where I can't even look at a calendar anymore because I can't process it. So, and it's also a great excuse if somebody comes up and says we need to schedule. I'm like, I don't do calendars. I don't ask me to schedule anything because I'll forget. So every morning I know I just have to go and react to stuff, and I'm usually going in and reacting to things until 11 o'clock or midnight. Whether it's we were working on the main title sequence, and that was fun working with Brian Reitzel, and we were in the studio, and it just there's so many aspects of a show that has this many visual effects in it that we just have to be much more involved than any other show that I've ever worked on, because Hannibal was easy compared to what we're doing here.
That was a show, I mean, of,
and that wasn't easy.
Well, no, of course, but as baroque as that show was, a lot of those effects were practical, right? I mean, you had to actually have a tree covered in flowers with a corpse growing out of it and not creating that in post, right?
Well, everything gets touched up in posts. And that tree bloomed flowers and went psychedelic for some Will Graham mind trip. So we had to design that. And so there was a lot of stuff on Hannibal that was very velvety in texture and dark. And that gave us, the ability to hide things, about the production, because we weren't a big budget show, and if you look too close at certain sets, they didn't. It's like, oh, I see the stage floor. So plunge it into darkness.
Shadows are your friend.
So to add on to the last question, I know that when you are writing, it seems like that's all you're doing.
Yes.
And I have often thought to myself when I see, like, you'll post something on Twitter or Facebook and talking about you're going off here to write at some weird time of the day. And the question is, when do you sleep?
During Hannibal, I didn't sleep. That was pretty crazy. It was, and on Pushing Daisies, there wasn't a lot of sleep. On American Gods, there was a little more sleep because we wrote most of it before we started shooting it. So that allowed some rest. But when I'm in the thick of it, I don't get a lot of sleep.
Do you have a preferred time of day? Like, are you most productive, early in the morning or late at night? Or
I'm actually most productive at night, but that eats up into the day because, sometimes you'll be at the office. If I get out of the office early, like say 7 or 8, I can then go home and get 4 hours of writing in before I have to get up at 7 to do something else. And so it's there. It's interesting the perception of sort of those who would say that Hollywood is in a bubble and they're not like the real hardworking Americans. People in the entertainment industry work their asses off. Like the crews, like they're 17-hour days, 6 days a week, Fraturdays, so they don't really get a break. And it's people who are really excited to be working in the entertainment industry and providing something that is a sweet distraction for an hour or two. All I wanted.
Yeah. That was my last. What do you got, Alonzo?
I think we kind of covered everything that I had been thinking about. I'm sure as we start taking questions from the audience, I'll maybe have some follow-ups for those. So if folks in the audience have questions, please raise your hand, and the gentleman with a microphone will come fetch you. And I believe we have a hand over here.
Hello. I'm a big fan of most of the shows. Well, I love all your shows, but my favorites are the ones dealing with death. And my favorite thing about the shows is the whimsical approach to death. Do you know what happened to you that you developed that, or is that...
There were a lot of funerals when I was a kid, because my mom was the youngest of, like, 11 kids, and so there were a lot of, like, uncles who were dropping dead, and so I just remember going to funerals and being made to feel okay, because everybody was going out of their way to make the child comfortable at, that event. So I never associated them with negativity, just sort of an unfortunate reality that gives you a chance to celebrate someone. And also, I've got a really dark sense of humor, and there was a serial killer in where I grew up, and like while I was going through puberty, that was killing girls around my age. So there was something very bizarre about testicles dropping while body parts are dropping, and making connections that I probably wouldn't have if there wasn't a serial killer.
Did they catch this person?
No, they didn't, and it's a great story. There's a great documentary called Confluence, if you want to know about the serial killer. They never caught him, but everybody who's from that town knows exactly who did it, but there was never enough proof.
Say the name of the documentary again?
Confluence, because it's the confluence of the Snake River and the Clearwater River. It's a good documentary. It's sad. It's fucked up.
For your original ideas, where do you come up with your ideas? I mean, is it something you saw in the news, something you experienced personally, someone you talked to? Does it just come to you?
Sometimes it's a scene. Sometimes it's a scene in a different movie where I'm like, oh, it would have been interesting if they went that way. Like, oh, that's a story. So it's – a lot of it is images. Like I think visually, and when I write a script, I write very visually as well. It's like camera does this, camera finds this, and so a lot of them, you know, like anything, any artist is a product of every artist who's come before them, and so it's you know the lifetime of influences that are eaten up and digested and come out in different orders that have, you know, a variety of influences. I know what Hannibal is fueled by David Lynch, you know, so that gives me tone and an abstraction and also a distinct point of view on reality. So, sometimes it's about coming up with a story and saying, okay, how do I tell this? Like, who's, you know, with Hannibal, I put on my David Lynch hat and I was like, what would Hannibal do? Or what would David Lynch do with Hannibal? And so I was inspired by that artist trying to recreate what I thought a version of, a weird show that might, spark obsessions might be.
I just wanted to throw out real quick, speaking of your originals, this wound up being a movie. It was going to be a series, and I really have an affection for it. I want to ask real quick about High Moon.
Yes, yes.
Which I think was a rich idea for sort of an ongoing thing, and I would have loved to see where that would have gone. But tell us a bit about where that came from and how it wound up the way it wound up.
Jim Gray, who started out as a writer's assistant on Pushing Daisies and then quickly became a staff writer. He went on a meeting on a property that I had met with like several years ago and didn't spark to it. And I was like, okay, I don't really see what this is because it was based on the Lotus Caves and it was a children's story. And I was like, I don't know what's going to fuel me to tell that story. And then Jim was like, oh, I had a meeting on the Lotus Caves. And I was like, oh, yeah. And he was like, I want to do it as James Bond on the moon. And I was like, that I can get behind. And so I helped Jim break the story and really just got to be Jim's champion and help him guide the story. But it was really mostly Jim's work. And there was a lot of that cast. I love that cast. It was really fun. Chris Diamantopoulos and Jonathan Tucker, both of whom came on to do Hannibal. Constance Wu, who is fresh off the boat. And, it was a fun experience. And we had such cool things planned for that show, including like a colony of evolved Russian chimpanzees that were sent up in rocket ships and then crashed on the moon and then evolved their own Planet of the Apes culture and were living underneath the moon. So we were going to do Planet of the Apes on the moon with Russian chimpanzees. And the network was like, you're just trying to be weird. And it was like, no, I want to see Russian chimpanzees with Moon of the Apes. I think it's really fucking cool.
Did they not know they were talking to Brian Fuller?
They didn't get it.
Of course you were trying to be weird.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm sure I'm not the only one who was really excited to hear that Brian Reitzel is also scoring American Gods, because his score in Hannibal is just so incredible and the soundscapes that he creates are amazing. And you said that you guys have been pretty involved with the sound design in American Gods, and I'm just curious, like, do you have a music background that kind of helps you guide him, or what kind of parameters do you give him when he's scoring something?
Well, with Brian is a musical genius on a level that I can only see the light from where I'm standing. And so, I can only contribute, my experience from listening to soundtracks for you know, the first 20 years of my life in headphones and really studying film composers so I can, you know, I can offer insight in terms of what about this instrument here and what about that instrument here, or drop references that might mean something to him. But it's really jamming with Brian and trying to stay in his wake, because it's a cool wake to be in. But it's, I think, what he did with the Hannibal score, I thought was genius and gorgeous. And I love the Susie Sue song that he composed. And, you know, there's, wait till you hear the Shirley Manson song that we have. That's Laura's theme, which is fantastic. And, so it's, he's just really cool and knows a lot of artists. So, it's fun to ride with him because he goes places that are unexpected. And we have the opening of episode 5 is all animated because it's set, you know, in prehistoric times, about like one of the very first gods, and he composed the entire sequence with only instruments that would be around in primal, you know, earth. So everything is either skin or stick, and it's the coolest thing that I've ever heard. And I was like, please send that to Susie Sue and ask her to write lyrics to it, because I it feels like one of her creatures escapades. I think you're in for a treat with what he's doing. I'm glad you're excited.
Yes, in back.
Hi. So referencing the story you told about Orlando Jones nailing it on that speech, are you using a writer's room to kind of help you round out the experiences of a diverse cast, or are you relying on your cast members to kind of give you some points of reference on their lived experiences with that?
Well, yeah, the both of those things. We had a fantastic writing staff on American Gods, and also, you know, we're very aware of the opportunity that we had in the show that was about exploring so many other cultures. Of our, the chances that we had to cast non-white actors was very exciting to us, and also something that Neil, you know, it wasn't even an issue in any way, and it has been for me with other studios and networks, where it'll be like, okay, if you cast that person as non-white, then you have to surround her with a bunch of white guys. And it's like, why can't there be more than one? But with American Gods, it was actually very interesting in the casting process, because Shadow Moon is mixed race, and there were black actors that we thought were great that came in, and it was really the network that led the charge, and they were saying, well, that's a black actor, and Shadow in the book is mixed race, like it's unclear. And so that was, it's a fun thing to be a part of, because I know so many fantastic non-white actors that it's also, we aren't colorblind casting. We are color casting. We want the ethnicity and the diversity. And, Neil is very specific about it, because there was a role, Mama G in the book, who is an Indian goddess that they meet at House on the Rock. And they just describe her as a very dark-skinned woman. And I was like, what do you think about casting Grace Jones? And because I was like, fucking A, we're going to cast Grace Jones on this show. And he was like, Grace Jones is an Indian. Mama G is an Indian goddess. And I was like, but she's very dark-skinned. And he's like, here are these Bollywood actresses that I like. And so that's, even when we try to cheat for somebody spectacular like Grace Jones, Neil's there to say, no, it has to be that culture. It has to be representative of that ethnicity. And it was an interesting, speaking of High Moon, there was an interesting aspect, to the casting process, for the part that Constance Wu played. And it was, you know, we talked a lot about Asian specificity, because if she's a Japanese actor, and I I believe Constance is Chinese and has Japanese in her family, which is how I was sort of like, I can wrap my head around that. But we had another actor who was good that was Filipino, and I was like, she's Filipino, and unless you change that to be from the Philippines, you know, a Philippine space station, we need to cast somebody who has Japanese blood in them for this role. And because it's very easy to just pretend that Asian is just one kind of people, and there's so many different kinds of Asians. And I know this because my roommate in college was an Asian lesbian, and they would have Asian lesbian makeout parties to gay porn, and I learned a lot about the variety of how not to mix one with the other.
Just speaking of, because it is Lambda Literary, and speaking of Asian lesbians, can you talk about how, like, maybe a queer sensibility or a gay sensibility informs your writing? And when you are writing, are you like, I could put a gay character in here, or a queer, or does it in any way?
Yeah, it absolutely does, because I do feel there's a responsibility, and, you know, it's, you know, on Wonder Falls, Sharon, Jay's sister, was a lesbian Republican, and we had fun with her. Katie Finneran was amazing. And then on Pushing Daisies, it was so gay in sensibility that, like, halfway through the first season, I was like, we don't have any gay. I mean, the whole show is gay as fuck, but we don't have any gay characters. And then I was like, okay, the coroner, we're going to do a whole story with the coroner who has a crush on Shy McBride. And then we got canceled. So, and then with Hannibal, I thought about, we were initially going to make Chilton the gay character, and then Will and Hannibal turned out pretty gay, so it became all about the subtext. And then also we had Margot and Alana, which was really fun to do, because Carolyn DeVarnes, who played Alana Bloom and Hannibal and Jay in Wonder Falls, came up and was like, okay, I've had sex with Hugh and I've had sex with Maz. Now I want to have sex with Katie. I want to do a sex scene with Katie. And I was like, well, why don't we do a whole storyline where these two get together? And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I want to do another season of Hannibal, is that there's so much Margot and Alana story. Like, if you have the lesbian couple versus the homoerotic male couple, like, who knows? There's something really fun about pitching those couples against each other. And then with American Gods, Salim was right there in one of my favorite chapters of the book. And both Michael and I loved the tale of Salim and the djinn. And it felt also like there was an opportunity to have a commentary about what it's like to be a gay Muslim man. And, you know, in season two, we have Salim's Coming to America plan, that where we're going to see exactly how he got to America and what life was like when he was living in a place where gays get thrown off rooftops. And then also the scene with Salim and Jin in the book, I remember being very impactful, because it was very coy about saying Salim was a gay character. I mean, up until he had a dick in his mouth, and then it was clear, but they were coy about it. But they made references about, the sex that he's had has usually been rushed and in an alleyway or a bathroom. And you got that there was somebody who never actually had a healthy, positive sexual experience. And that became so important to us to bring that story to life. And that was one of the emails that we got from Neil after he saw that completed sequence with the visual effects, which is this trippy sex scene that I think is pretty hot.
It's that you got, again, the stuff you got away with on just network television with Hannibal never ceased to amaze me. And that you got away with this on even premium cable I'm kind of shocked.
We wanted to give Salim a happy, healthy sexual expression. And there's a moment where, because in the book, he just blows the gin and, Bob's your uncle. but we even had a moment where, Salim drops to his knees because he's like, this is how I have sex. I just blow the guys and then they go away. And the djinn lifts him up off of his knees and they start kissing very tenderly. And it was this wish fulfillment for all of the Salims out there who are so shamed by their sexuality and their expressions of sexuality are so constricted that they might see this experience and just realize it's okay to be that way. And I hope there's lots of Salims out there that are wank banking the sequence to the end of time, because it's this close to porn. Like it's pornographic.
You also gave Katie Finneran one of my favorite lines ever in an early episode of Wonderfalls, where this guy is not getting through to him why she's not interested in him, and she finally has to say, because your genitals are on the outside. I've just been quoting that for years. The other sort of queer sensibility thing, I just kind of wanted to circle back to Carrie again, because I think that book and film, because of the sort of outsiderdom of it, has been really kind of treasured by queer audiences for generations at this point. And I'm wondering if you were thinking about ways to sort of overtly or covertly work that kind of sensibility into your version, or if the story itself kind of just does it all for you.
I think there's an interesting adaptation of Carrie where she's a gay character, that takes away the Tommy Ross of it all. But, I was just like, oh my God, I get it right, Carrie. So I put some, you know, girl humor in there, but, I think if I was doing that adaptation today, I would do it a little more politically aggressive.
Yes.
Hi. I have a question. As a writer, how do you, when you're generating content sort of, you know, from the brow of Zeus, as it were, how do you keep yourself to a deadline? Or as a showrunner running a writer's room, how do you keep writers on a deadline where they sort of, I run a show, and run into this problem sometimes where I have asked writers to create something out of their own minds and then ask for it on a deadline, and they go, but my writing, it's so precious, I need more time. How do you, as a person who works in the real world with real deadlines, deal with that outside pressure and still hit it?
Right now, studio executives and networks who've worked with me in the past are howling with laughter that you would ask me that question. It's really, you know, particularly when you're trying to do something differently. Like, for instance, on our sound mixes for the first episode of Hannibal of American Gods is so complex, and we didn't have enough time scheduled in the network or in the studio. We're like, you know, we had 3 days. It's like, well, it's going to take 5 days. And that just seems to be a recurring issue. I look at deadlines in the rearview mirror after I pass them and then try to figure out how to keep the people I owe material to happy. But it's hard, particularly when you're trying to do something different. And it's easier for me to meet a deadline when I'm adapting somebody else's material than it is when it's mine, because I'm much harder on what I'm writing than I am on anything that I'm adapting, because I know that the story already works, so it doesn't need the hypercritical scrutiny that I give the stuff that I do that's original.
Hi. Every Star Trek series has, in some interesting way, been groundbreaking for various things. Is there anything that you're looking forward to being a part of for Discovery that you're finding a new opportunity to kind of break some ground, be it, you know, finding a way to cast more of a diverse, color or gender background? Or it's one of those things to where, because it is the future and it is a utopia, is there something that you're excited about bringing to that now that you have more control than you have in the past?
Well, I'm no longer working on Star Trek. I developed the show and wrote the first couple of scripts and then handed that off. I was part of the casting process for Michelle Yeoh and Sinequa, and there's something very exciting about when I sat down to imagine this version of Star Trek for myself. I was really inspired by Mae Jemison and Ruby Bridges. And I thought, what if Ruby Bridges happened in a Star Trek era and grew up to be an astronaut? Who would that little girl become, who had that responsibility and that weight thrust upon her at a very early age? And, you know, I love those pictures. It's so iconic. So, Voyager really, did us right with Captain Janeway, and it was time for that as a leader. But I'm very happy that the first captain that you meet on Star Trek Discovery is an Asian female, and she's also Michelle Yeoh, which, you know, doesn't suck. But I think there's, as we get into more and more programming and looking at, like, I'm very jealous of The Walking Dead's casting. I think it's fantastically inclusive, and I was thrilled that Sinequa is going to be leading Discovery, because I think she was fantastic on The Walking Dead, so we called it the Vagenda when we were doing Discovery, because there was one scene where there was an admiral, a captain, and a first officer, and two of those characters were written as men, and I wanted them all to be women, and that was part of the let's just be interesting in the casting process as opposed to putting it on the page, because, you know, pick your battles. But I'm excited for those types of moments when you see three strong women in a scene and nobody's asking why one of them isn't a guy.
Yes.
Hence my suit.
This conversation is reminding me about the Bechdel test and how that's gone through this weird wave of being the standard by which people talk about this stuff, to now you have a sort of a newer wave of feminist critics saying, well, it's not enough, it doesn't go far enough. And so I'm just curious, because you've had so many female protagonists and female characters who were integral to plots in ways that had nothing to do with the men in the story, going all the way back to Dead Like Me, I'm just curious about the process of inclusion for you, and then also of feeling like you're writing them right as a gay man.
I think I just had female role models growing up that, and it was, you know, it was Erin Gray and Lindsay Wagner and Linda Carter, and there were strong women that I was seeing all the time, and that because I didn't relate to the men in the stories, that I was admiring Wonder Woman and Wilma Deering and the Bionic Woman, and it felt like those were characters that inspired me, that their gender didn't have anything to do with their heroism. I've said before, seeing Princess Leia as a little kid, 7 years old, and wanting to be R2-D2 in that story because R2-D2 is the one who wanted to help Princess Leia and not just to fuck her. So I was there's a lot of great female characters in genre storytelling, and that was this, those were the stories that I was watching. So it just seemed natural to that those characters would be, you know, I guess a lot of them are, you know, they're named girls with boy names, which is sort of blurring gender anyway, and just saying, well, because I don't think of, I had this brief conversation with a critic before we had cast Michelle Yeoh and Star Trek, who said, well, you can't write a man and then cast a woman. You have to write the character as a woman. And I was like, that's bullshit. Like, that happens all, like, Ripley was a man. So I think it's, women think about things differently than men think about things for a variety of reasons, and they watch horror movies for different reasons, and men and women are not the same, but people are the same, if that makes sense.
Hi. In terms of American Gods, if this is something that's part of the show, do you have any thoughts on how you approach the psychology of American mythology and what we as a culture worship?
Oh, yeah, that's a lot of the fun of that show, is being able to have those conversations and write those conversations about what do we believe in, where do we put our faith. And for those of you who don't know, American Gods is based on the concept of thought form, which is if you believe in it enough, you can manifest it into reality. And so all of these gods have been manifested into reality by their believers, and then those believers migrated to America and started believing in Buddhism or Islam or Christianity, one of the big three, and they fell to the side. So what was your question again? Sorry. So there is something to that immigrant experience, and, you know, for somebody who, like, imagining a character who doesn't exist except for people that believed in them, and so their biggest fear is being forgotten, and if you knew that was your lifeline, then you'd want to make sure that's preserved. And you'd also be a little crazy because you're dependent on other people's beliefs, but it also allows us to extrapolate, okay, like we have the god Vulcan, who is not in the book, and the god Vulcan is god of the volcano, and what is the modern extrapolation of a volcano god in American society? Well, it might be somebody who's obsessed with guns, because a gun is like holding a volcano in your hand. You can, you know, pull a trigger and erupt and make a sacrifice and take life. So there's aspects of that we get to suggest to the audience as a conversation piece, and also, you know, our iPhone culture and Bilquis, who's the character who is a love goddess who, you know, eats people with her vagina. She's got an app, you know, she's got a Tinder Grindr app, and that's how she, in her union with the new gods who are trying to franchise the old gods and make them relevant in today's society, of course they're going to create an app, a sex date app for a goddess of love to gain worship. So we get a look at those things in an interesting context, and it's always interesting to us because we're looking at it and we're seeing the ideas behind it and we're seeing the wonderful performances by the characters, but we're very curious to see how much of that is going to come through to the audience when they see the show, because we're living in a bubble with it. Did that come through when you saw it?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I saw sort of two episodes out of order, but the context makes sense. You provide a through line, because I haven't read the book, right. So I was coming in totally cold, and yeah, I know it works.
I hope you like it.
All right.
No.
Oh, well, I was going to say thank you, Brian Fuller. Thank you, Alonso Duralde. And Dave White. Oh. Yes.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
And Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here tonight. Check out lambdalitfest.org for the rest of the week's programming. You guys were incredible tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everybody.